Okay, Erev Tov. I don't know, are we the end of winter, beginning of spring? Anyway, okay. This is really for this season, the last of our medieval Jewish, you know, thinkers. I think up to now, the first three we had have been, you know, excellent. I think all three of them, and we look forward to continuing this as we move forward. And tonight, we have a local boy, if I can say that, a local professor, Dr. Diamond, who I'm sure many of you know. He actually originally was a lawyer for many years. All people who originally have a career and then move into Jewish studies are people who are automatically close onto my heart. And he's been the head of the Department of Jewish Studies at University of Waterloo for the last, already, I'm sure, over a decade. I was going to 11 years. And really, he teaches in a place where you wouldn't expect there to be an interest in Jewish studies. And Paul Sokin is here, of course, who is responsible for the establishment of the program, and give you, I guess, a yesher koach on that. And it's a pleasure to have you. You know, Dr. Diamond has done a lot of work on the Rambam. And I remember he spoke for us a couple years ago on the Rambam, and he mentioned, I just remember in passing, I said, you know, if you read the commentary of the Rambam on Chumash, and he said, you know, I've read the entire commentary of the Ramban, you'll see very fascinating, you know, person. Of course, the Ramban is one of the major leaguers, if we can use such an analogy, and really lived in the sort of in the generation after the Ramban, and has been one of the most important influences in Jewish life to this day. And without further ado, a pleasure to have Dr. Dami with us.
Thanks, Jay. It's Professor. Don't worry about the source sheets. I know they're in Hebrew. I just can't get a hold of the English, but I'll translate everything for those who don't know. Picking up on what Jay said, I would say from my readings, and of course I can't say that I've read everything, close, but I would say that the two Rishonim, what we call Rishonim, or the two thinkers from the Middle Ages that tower probably above everybody else are Maimonides and Nachmanides, the two iddies, the two families of Nachman and the family of Maimon. And what is interesting about that, and everybody else I think kind of just falls a number of levels below, even in terms of Rishonim, in terms of medieval authorities who are considered the greatest authorities after kind of the Geonic authorities. I would say, with no exaggeration, that they offer two totally different models of Judaism. That is, and this might sound radical, but after reading both of them for many years, I would say that they, in faith, in belief, actually had two different religions. In practice, they practiced, of course, more or less the same religion. That is, halacha bound them, barring technical disagreements. Of course, we have disagreements about halacha disagreements. But in thought, in virtually every subject, be it prophecy, providence, miracles, angels, even the nature of God, who we worship, we're so holy. I'm not talking about minor details. I'm talking about essential details, that it would really render the two of them, when they thought about who, when they davened, perhaps, who they were davening to, they were thinking about different beings. I say this actually with no exaggeration. I say it at the beginning just to wake people up, because people might fall asleep during my presentation. But let's talk about Ramban. And I'll get rid of the biographical details quickly, because I'm not really a historian. I'm more philosophically minded. That's my training. But we're talking about Rav Moshe ben Nachman, also called Nachmanides, born in Girona. We're talking 1194 to 1270, approximately. We're talking about the 13th century northern Spain, what was called, and what was still called up until this day, Franco actually repressed them, but almost a different country, Catalonia, a different language. But what you need to know is that the cultural environment was very, very different than the cultural environment of somebody like Maimonides. And I'll use the contrast with Maimonides in this lecture as a way to highlight Nachmanides' thought, because I think that's the best way. He challenged Maimonides on many of these issues, and I think that's a good way of conveying what exactly he stood for in terms of various issues in Judaism, in terms of our belief. Catalonia, or Girona, where he was raised and studied and practiced and became the head of the community, I would say was the crossroads between kind of the rationalism of what we called Andalusia, or southern Spain, where Maimonides came from, and northern France, where typified perhaps by Rashi. The two cultures, the two environments could not be more different in terms of their influences, in terms of the challenges that they posed. And those influences, of course, affected their thought and the development of the thought and the way they conceived Judaism. So that Rashi, for instance, northern France, to be quick about it, was not philosophical, was not interested in philosophy. I don't think Rashi was really familiar with philosophy, so to speak, the philosophy of the day. Andalusia or Maimonides were steeped in the host culture, the secular culture, which is a misnomer, but we'll use it for now. The philosophy of the day, very, very influenced by that philosophy. Nachmanides, who was in northern Spain at this time, is a thoroughly Christianized environment. That is, it's not under Muslim rule. So Andalusia, Maimonides, is really identified with Islamic culture. Rashi, northern France, is identified with Christianity. And when we say the Middle Ages, Dark Ages, when we call those the Dark Ages and the connotations that go with that, that really only applies to Christian Middle Ages. It does not apply to Islamic Middle Ages. That is, the Islamic Middle Ages were probably the peak of civilization at that time. So Maimonides perhaps lived in the bright Middle Ages, and Rashi lived in the dark Middle Ages. That's not to disparage Rashi, but I just want to distinguish between the cultures. So Nachmanides was in the unique position of living in a crossroads, in a kind of transition between the two cultures. So, as I said, born in 1194, if we go to the, he was also called by other names, or Moshe ben Nachman is his Hebrew name, Ramban is the acronym. In Catalonia, the name was Bonastrug Da, or Sa. Porta, don't ask me what that means, Porta probably means door, but we know that from royal annals, was not only prolific in terms of his output in all areas of Jewish thought. And that's what makes Nachmanides and Maimonides tower above everybody else, is that very often you'll have people who specialize in one area, perhaps Kabbalah, perhaps philosophy. But Maimonides and Nachmanides were not easy to dismiss because they towered over everyone and were the giants of their generations in all areas of law. And what I mean by that is, if Maimonides were just a philosopher and if Nachmanides were just a Kabbalist, we wouldn't be talking about them much today, except in some classes where I teach. But because they towered in those areas, but in all the traditional areas of Judaism, and what I mean by that is halakha, Maimonides, of course, writing one of the most important treatises of halakha, Mishneh Torah, they are ones that have to be met by everybody since they came on the scene. So nobody can easily dismiss either of them. So in terms of biographical material, he's well known, if we move up ahead in his life, as a community leader, as prolific in all areas of Jewish thinking, that is halakha, Kabbalah, exegesis, that is biblical commentary, polemics. One of the medieval figures that one cannot attend the yeshiva without confronting in terms of learning Talmud, as one can't Maimonides in terms of Kiddushei Ramban, his novella, his interpretations of the Talmud, and the list goes on. It is amazing that someone who was a community leader and was close, had access to the king, actually, at that time, King Jaime James, was also able to produce and be so prolific in his thought in many, many aspects. And I would say that although I spent most of my scholarly career, that is, in terms of my scholarly output, studying the Rambam, and Maimonides, in the last few years I have published a number of articles on the Ramban. And though I can't say that I am convinced by his philosophy of life, I would say that in some ways he is much more complex than Maimonides. That is, Maimonides is complex in terms of finding out what exactly he concluded on many, many different areas. But whatever he did, I'm convinced that he was consistent. That is, he was a rationalist, and he was a rationalist through and through, from beginning to end. And there are contradictions, but setting aside the contradictions between various writings, I think he was consistent, rigidly consistent, on all issues. Nachmanides has very, very many different dimensions that don't seem to go together, and that is, there's this Kabbalistic dimension, which kind of sends him into outer space very often. Then there's this very rigid pshat, that is where he takes on, for instance, people like Rashi on agadic interpretations that he says this can't be, this doesn't make any sense for rational reasons. He has that Talmudic, that halachic dimension, the communal dimension. He was also a physician. So in many ways in his real life, in his physical life, in his active life, was like Maimonides. But he seems to kind of embody very, very many different dimensions that don't seem to go together, that went together very nicely in Maimonides. If we move up a little bit in terms of biographical detail, another thing that he's very, very well known for is a disputation in Barcelona in the latter half of the 13th century, where he was forced. No Jew would want to enter voluntarily into disputations with the governing regime. And of course, entering into disputation with Christians in a Christian-governed country posed many, many difficulties, one of which that you didn't really want to win it too strongly. King James was in attendance, and his opponent was a converted Jew, as often they were. Pablo Cristiani, that was his kind of Latinized name, who was very familiar with the Jewish traditions and was able to meet Nachmanides head on. And we have a report, actually two reports, both from the Christian side and from the Jewish side, from Nachmanides himself, wrote Sefer HaVikuach. You can actually read these. The standard editions of them are by a guy named Chavel, Chavel. Who published two volumes of the works. And who won the debate is, of course, subject to which report you read. But in that debate, which is fascinating on its own, one would think that perhaps Nachmanides gained the upper hand. He was forced thereafter, after writing down his version of the events, once the Franciscans, the Dominicans got a hold of it, they banned it, they burned it, and he was forced, actually, in the last years of his life, perhaps as a favor to him, maybe ultimately, he ended up in Israel for the last 3 or 4 years of his life. And you still can still see, if you go to the Old City, you can still see the Shul of the Ramban, whether that's the actual Shul of the Ramban. He did start a congregation there. We have a report from him that there were, at that time, and we're talking here towards the latter half of the 13th century, if he died in 1270, this would have been in 1267 or something like that. He says there were basically two Jews there in Jerusalem, two dyers, and who had to get a minyan every Shabbos together. This, whether that's an exaggeration or not, but it clearly reflects the times. The other biographical detail that he was well known for is the Maimonidean controversy, where he acted as a mediator. That is, there was a raging controversy. So if you think politics and controversy and people yelling at other people that you're not a Jew and I'm the correct Jew is just something new in our time, you got something else coming. There was a raging controversy over Maimonides' writings, not just his philosophical writings, but the first book of the Mishneh Torah, which is philosophical in nature, Sefer Hamada, which ended up in bans, that is, cherem, excommunications, on both sides, ended up with the burning of books, his books, by the Christian authorities, because our people, it is a reflection on repression, but it is also a reflection, because I often hear kind of idealized versions, but as a scholar I have to say that I have to tell the truth, that is, largely because of us, they burned our books. Because those who were anti-Maimonidean actually gave over those who they considered heretics to the Christian authorities and said, this is heresy. What Maimonides is saying is heresy. What the followers of Maimonides is heresy. You burn their books, burn ours. And this is no exaggeration. We have actually texts from people like Rabbeinu Yonah Gerundi, very, very respected in our tradition, one of the famous Rishonim or medieval authorities, who actually went to the Franciscans and the Dominicans and said to them they have to do something about Jewish heresies. Okay, enough of that. True. But Nachmanides acted as a mediator. That is, because perhaps he was at the crossroads, he acted as a mediator diplomatically. I think I know what he believed, and I don't think it was what Maimonides believed in. But basically, he offered a compromise, a pshara. That is, you got to understand where Maimonides comes from. It comes from this culture. You got to understand where we come from, the Tosafist culture, the Northern France culture. This is good for that culture. This is not good for our culture. Try to have them understand the situation and that this has its place. Didn't succeed too well. But that was his role in that controversy, which was, as I say, a very raging controversy and fueled by all kinds of things. It could be politics as well. So what I'd like to do is now, after giving you a little biographical sketch of his life, is talk about various issues, and it's hard to kind of nail down in 45 minutes or 50 minutes or 2 hours if you would like. Everybody, don't worry about it. Whenever you want me to stop, I can stop. But a few kind of central issues to Judaism, and in terms of kind of fleshing out where Nachmanides stood, pose him in contrast to Maimonides. So first I'll start with the first source on your page, and again, I'll don't worry about the Hebrew, which is the introduction to his commentary on the Torah, the great commentary on the Torah. In there, that first source basically says what he's going to do. But one of the things that is important that I highlighted here is that he's going to take people like Rashi, and he says, Perush Rabbeinu Shlomo, and he kind of gives them all kinds of accolades, Mukhtar b'ni Musav b'mikra b'mishna v'gmara, expert in all areas of Judaism, Lo Mishpat HaBechora, to him is due the rule of the firstborn, B'dvarav Egeh, with his words, I will engage, Ba'avatam eshke, with love I will be infatuated with them, V'imahem yelanu masamatan, with them we will have discussion, Drisha v'chakira, inquiry, investigation, which should give you an idea which people, most people, really, really don't remember. Because what people remember, what people note, is his great conflict with Maimonides, which is there. I would say, after reading Nachmanides' commentary a number of times from beginning to end, that the person he took on was Rashi. this is for a number of reasons. I can go into it. It's not portrayed that way. But if you go through, and there are dozens and dozens and dozens of places where he uses the following language with respect to Rashi. I'll start with the easiest. Lo nirali. It doesn't seem to me to be the case. Einenu nachon. It's not correct. Ein tam bereach. There's no rhyme or reason to this. And you can, I have all the sources. You can ask me, you can email me. But this goes on and on. I can say that I can pick up and just simply randomly open up a page on any Mikraot Gedolot and find a dispute, a challenge to Rashi. And you see it in his introduction. He tells you. My spiel is, when he says, Lo Mishpat HaBechora, perhaps this is speculation, but perhaps true, often these people were masters at irony as well. We know what happens to every Bechor in Chumash, don't we? So there you have it. Every Bechor is usurped. Every single one, right? That's the theme. I don't think Nachmanides missed that, and perhaps his audience wouldn't have either. Just a thought. The other person that he's going to take on is Rabbi Avraham ben Ezra. Ibn Ezra, with him, Tielanu Tochacha Mugula, V'ava Misuter. That is, we'll have concealed love and open rebuke. He turns, if people would just bother to read his introduction, everything that they thought about Ramban immediately is turned on its head. The people they think he takes on, Rambam, and Ibn Ezra, who is particularly also very controversial, are the people that he may feel closer to, and Rashi, the people think that he's closest to, actually he takes on. When you say open rebuke and concealed love, that should tell you something. Okay, conception of Torah, and perhaps I had all kinds of things. Perhaps that might be the only one we can get to. But conception of Torah is, of course, fundamental to Judaism and to our lives. So the second source, I would say, is so antithetical to the way somebody like Maimonides looked at that they were reading two different books. This is what he says. Od yesh biyadenu kabbalat shel emet. We have a tradition. Ki kol, listen to this, kol ha-Torah kula shmotav shel ha-Kadosh Baruch Hu. The entire Torah consists of the names of God. Hu she'atevot mitchalkot l'shemot. If you know how to read this, there's an oral tradition alongside with the written tradition, just like those terms that I'm sure you're all familiar with, Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebalpeh, that have its traditional meaning. For the Ramban, that pair has an entirely different meaning. The Torah Shebichtav is the Torah that we have, the narratives and the laws. The Torah Shebalpeh is the way we can read the Torah as the names of God. A mystical concept. And it seems to him, and I'll go on, that the Midrash, that the Torah was given, black fire on white fire, exactly conveys this notion of the Torah. Of course, black fire on white fire is not something we can possibly read. You can't articulate black fire on white fire. That is the writing of the Torah with no interruptions, no grammar, no breaks in the language, a continuum of letters with which you can do lots of things. That is a continuum of letters that don't even have to be read in their chronological sequence. Now, if that's the conception of Torah, Maimonides' conception of Torah was much more, in a sense, pragmatic, functional. The Torah is simply may be the wrong word, simply a primer. The Torah is, albeit the best, the most perfect, teaching of morality and philosophy. I don't have enough time to go into that. Take it from me. That's true. That is, the Torah is not this conception, decidedly not. It is a book that we learn practical philosophy and theoretical philosophy. What to believe and what to do. Let me give you an example, which is source 3, of what Nachmanides does with this conception of the Torah. That is, you can do all kinds of things with the Torah, and he says this, I don't have it in the source, but he says it, you can look at it as an introduction to the Torah. Because the Torah is presented or formulated in this way, you can do all kinds of things with the letters. That is, the letters melt away. The narratives and the kind of logical sequence of words melt away, and you can combine them in different ways. And here I have a very fundamental way that he does it. Im tiskeh v'tavin sod milat breshit. If you understand the secret, and when he says the secret, I can't by any means tell you that I understand what he's saying, because he's usually very cryptic. Lama lo hikdim, but this is something that exercised many, many mystics, many, many Kabbalists, the Zohar. Why the Torah? And of course, this isn't a question we would ask normally, but this is the Torah, and these are mystics looking at the Torah, and this is the divine language. Why doesn't the Torah start with God? The first word in the Torah is not God. The third word in the Torah is God. May not be a problem for us with our modern sensibilities, but it's a problem for the medieval mystics. Why not start with the most important being in the universe? Lama lo hikdim lomar Elokim bara breshit, that God created the beginning. And this has roots even in the Gemara, in the Septuagint, the way it was translated, but no time to go into that. Teda, no. Ki al derech ha'emet, this is a phrase that is a technical phrase in the Ramban, by way of truth. So very often, the Ramban, in his Perush, will give you a pshat, very often very pshat, even taking issue with Rashi's pshat. I don't know how Rashi got associated with pshat, but he did. Don't ask me. I'm puzzled by that. However, it also has to do with our notion of pshat. Most people have a very different notion of pshat than what the original term means. However, he takes issue with Rashi. I'll just give you a quick example, and there are many of them. When it says that the ram's horn was blown at Mount Sinai, Rashi says this was the ram of the Akedah. Ramban says, what are you talking about? How's that possible? And it's a midrash. He says the ram at the Akedah was a korban olah. It was a whole burnt sacrifice. It was all burnt up, so there's nothing left. There's no horns, there's no hooves, there's no nothing. So very, very pshat oriented. And he doesn't accept the midrash. And then he says there's a sod to it. There's a Kabbalistic understanding of this. So he takes issue on that score. But here, when he says, and so Derech Emet, he might introduce that by Derech Emet, give it a shot, and then introduce the second level by way of truth, where you know he's launching into kind of a mystical. And by the way, when we say mystical, the Ramban was one of the fathers, I would say the patriarchs, of our mysticism. That's not to say mysticism doesn't go back to biblical times, probably. I'm sure there were mystics in all times. But in terms of the Zoharic tradition, the Ramban precedes the Zohar. The Zohar did not crystallize until after the Ramban's time. Proof of the pudding is the Ramban never, ever, and this is the father of mysticism, who was very steeped in mysticism, never, ever mentions the Zohar. Never once. He does mention the Sefer HaBahir, which was around before the Zohar, but never mentions the Zohar. Now, when he says Derech HaEmet, this is what he says on Bereshit, the answer to that. Milat Bereshit Tirmoz B'Chachma. The word Bereshit alludes to Chachma, to wisdom. People who aren't familiar with Kabbalah will not know what he's talking about. People who are familiar with the spherotic notion of God and the world, that is God composed of 10 different kind of potencies, 10 different aspects, whatever you want to call it, the spherot, one of them is Chachma. The way he reads this, and he says this, I don't have it here, but he says this earlier on in the commentary, since you can read the text not the way it's sequentially written, but combine it in different sequences, Bereshit is read this way. Birosh, so the first letters of Bereshit, I hope I'm not losing people. Birosh, right? Yit bira, which is kind of taking the yud tuf from Bereshit, putting it together with the next word, Elohim. What that means is the following. Ready? In the beginning, God was created. In the beginning, God was created. Quickly, what that means is not in the beginning, but be, as some of you who might be familiar with Hebrew grammar, can mean besides in, with. What this means is, and this is in the Zohar as well, with the beginning, Reshit, and there's all kinds of symbolism, right? Reshit is the Sphira of Chachma, the first Sphira that emerges from the unknown Godhead. Chachma, wisdom. With Chachma, the unknown Godhead, the concealed one, and that's why it's not in the text, created Elohim, which is the next Sphira, Bina. Bina. So those who are familiar with Kabbalah will understand this. That is, there's all kinds of complex symbolism, but what he's saying is that is what this is saying. What it's saying is not just the narrative that we have, that in the beginning, which is also not quite correct, it's when God began to create, which should make you wonder whether the Bible itself actually believes in or espouses creation out of nothing. I don't think it does. I don't think that's the way the first verse reads at all. When God began to create the heaven and the earth, there were the following things. You will probably all know. There was tohu and bohu, which is untranslatable. There was darkness. There was water. There was rakia. There were all these things around when God began to create the world. But leaving that aside, for the Ramban, there are two levels. God created the world, and this is the other level, if you know how to read the Torah, is talking about the emergence of God, the embodiment of God, the creation of God, the way God works. In a sense, the Torah is a biography of God. It's not just historical narratives about Israel, but it reflects the history of God. And he says a number of times that whatever goes on down here reflects what goes on up there. So if one wants to read the ongoing commentary on Bereshit, I leave it to you, but you'll see that all through. That is, there is Gan Eden, there is the Garden of Eden, and there are the rivers. But there is also, by way of truth, another Garden of Eden. And there are four other rivers that refer to four other aspects of God. Whatever. This goes on and on. Adam is du partsufim. Adam, originally a creation, actually emerges out of the plain sense of the text. In the first report of the creation of man and woman, there are two reports, which people often don't remember. There's the report in chapter 1, there's the report in chapter 2. The report in chapter 1 is that man and woman are created together, not man first, and woman created out of the rib of man. And that is the locus classicus of all Kabbalistic thinking. That is the Tselem Elohim, the image of God, in which man, that is man as humankind, was created. That image is not morality, it's not intellect. For the Kabbalist, it is what it says. It is male and female, he created them. That's God. God is male and female. That's the image. The original, pristine, primordial human being was male and female. Okay, so very different conceptions. Maimonides takes the Garden of Eden story allegorically. Maimonides, I believe, does not think that you had a talking snake, but this is all an allegory about the human condition. I don't know, how much longer should I go on? You tell me, Jay. I can go on and on, but if, you know. Okay, so let me go on to number six, because that actually, fortuitously, has to do with the Inyana Diyama, the Parshat HaShavua. This week's Parsha is number six, sacrifices. Well-known Maimonidean theory about sacrifices, which is, one would say, if one wanted to use modern terms, historical, anthropological, social, psychological analysis of why we need korbanot. That is, for Maimonides, quickly, korbanot are not a good thing. Sacrifices is not something that we would ideally worship God with. However, as a concession to human nature, as a concession to the psyche of the time, that is, it was unheard of to worship gods by any other means than sacrifices, Maimonides says, God worked with that, right? You can't psychologically tell somebody, right, a heroin addict, and I don't think the analogy is actually exaggerated. You can't tell a heroin addict, stop and don't take any more heroin. You have to give him some kind of maybe pseudo-heroin for a while. You have to wean him off it. Exactly the same reason. Korbanot are meant to wean people off korbanot and to structure korbanot in such a way that it is the exact antithesis of what the idolaters believe korbanot are. So, for instance, just one example. You take those animals that the Egyptians considered sacred, like the sheep, and what do you do with them? Those are the animals you slaughter. So the thing that meant for the idolaters doom and catastrophe, which was the death of their sacred object, we would take and invert it, subvert it. That's his theory that undergirds all of sacrifices. So here you have, in the Parsha that's coming up, because Vayikra, of course, is a book that concerns itself largely, it's called the Leviticus, largely with priestly matters. So he mentions this, this is source 6, he mentions this notion, and this is what he says about it. Here he mentions no words. Vinehem divrei havai. Their nonsense is actually to be moderate. He has made the table of God despicable. Because his rationale is simply reduces korbanot to a way of combating fools. And then he goes on to say, no, Karbonot sacrifices have an intrinsic, inherent rationale. They're not meant as a concession. They're not meant simply to combat idolaters. They're meant to, and then he goes on to explain that it's as if I've sinned. This is me. This is a substitute for me. I'm on there. I'm burning myself. I'm sacrificing myself. I should be on there. Psychologically, this has a reason. Essentially, this has a reason. And then he has it has a secret reason, a Kabbalistic reason. But whatever it is, he is opposed vigorously to Maimonides' view of sacrifices because Maimonides reduces it to something pragmatic, something historical, and of course there's all kinds of problems that are associated with that in terms of the temporal validity of laws in the Torah. After all, korbanot probably take up, I didn't do a kind of a computational analysis, but I would say a good third of the Bible. Maimonides says basically, and the Ramban I think quite rightly takes him on, whether he's right or not, that's not for me to say, but Maimonides basically dismisses a large portion of the Torah. So that's one issue that makes their Judaism's kind of opposite, that is, polar opposites in terms of the way they conceive of the Torah. I'm going to do one more, and that is perhaps the idea of other gods and the demonic. That's number 8. The two worlds could not be more different on this score. That is, Maimonides thought that there was one divinity in the world. There were no powers. There were no demons. There were no what we call shadim. There were no angels. All this is nonsense. The Ramban believed thoroughly in a world that was populated, literally suffused, by powers all over the place. And here I'll give you just one striking instance. Some of you might know it, but it is striking. That is that the Seir HaMishtaleach, the goat that is sent to Azazel on Yom Kippur. I don't know, is everybody here familiar with that? So on Yom Kippur in the Bible, one goat, there's two korbanot, one goat is kind of the Kohen places his hand on there, all the sins of Israel is placed on the goat, and it's sent out to the wilderness, thrown down a mountain, gets torn to pieces, and all the sins of Israel are expiated. For Maimonides, this would cause quite a problem. So let me start with Maimonides. There is no doubt that sins cannot be carried like a burden and taken off the shoulder of one being to be laid on that of another being. That is, I've sinned, I'm heavy with sin. But I need to release myself. These ceremonies are of a symbolic character and serve to impress men with a certain idea and to induce them to repent. Clearly for the Rambam, it is symbolic. It has no inherent power, no intrinsic power. It's simply a teaching, a graphic teaching of repentance. Now, listen to Nachmanides. Hinei HaTorah asra legamri kabbalat elohutam v'kol avodah lahem. The Torah, of course, absolutely forbid any worship of their gods. Aval tziva HaKadosh Baruch Hu b'yom HaKippurim. However, a very, very important however, God commanded us on Yom Kippur shenishlach se'ir b'midbar, that we should send a goat to the desert, l'sar ha-moshel b'mekomot ha-churban, to the power that governs places of desolation. V'hu ha-roi loy, and that's fitting, mipnei shehu ba'alav u'me'atzilut kocho yavo churban chorev u'shmamon. And that's appropriate because it is from him, from that power, that destruction and catastrophe emanates. Ramban is saying exactly what he is saying What he is saying is that there, and this is one of many, and he actually takes on the Rambam head on this issue. What he is saying is that there are many powers and there are many gods, so to speak. This is a command of God to send a sacrifice to another, let's not call God, God with a small g, or a demon. The difference between the idolaters and us is that when we do this, we're carrying out the command of God, of the one God. That is, we are performing the will of God when we perform idolatry. I'll just say that to kind of maybe encourage some questions. So again, a very, very different conception of Judaism, of a mitzvah. Perhaps I'll do one more. One more. Which is, astrology as well. I mean, absolutely. Absolutely. Right, right. The Ramban was a believer in astrology. By the way, just in defense of the Ramban, in those days, astrology was not thought to be superstition. That is, they didn't read the newspapers and they read the horoscopes. They thought it was Ramban thought it was a science. So he actually, from his comments anyway, thought, you know, how could the Ramban? He says this when he takes him on in astrology. He says, how could the Ramban fly in the face of empirical observations? It's empirically proven, and as a doctor, the Ramban actually subscribed to this. That is, we can somehow manipulate astrological powers to better our lives. So the Ramban takes him on. However, the more essential point, you brought up a very important issue on that. Challenge the Rambam was when the Torah, and this is on when the Torah forbids all kinds of witchcraft and sorcery, there's all kinds of Ov, Yedoni, Mechshefa, the Ramban there, the Rambam says this is all nonsense. It's a waste of time. Astrology is a waste of time. He actually has a letter on astrology, which, not time to go into, very interesting, but basically astrology is a waste of time, nonsense. And that's why the Torah forbid it, because it's nonsense. The Ramban's actually, his argument against the Rambam, which is well taken, is why would the Torah take the time to confront nonsense? The Torah is taking the time to combat something that's very real. So the Ramban actually gives it much more importance. That is, the Torah is combating and challenging something that is much more important. And the Ramban has reduced it to some stupid he calls it tipshut, nonsense. And why would the Torah, why would God bother with just a fool's science? That's the answer to that. But angels is an interesting point. I think that highlights a lot of things. And this is source 7. So the Ramban believed in angels. No surprise if he believed in all these demons and believed in angels. But not only did he believe in angels, if we think that our religion is so much more logical than Christianity, how could a divine essence come down incarnate? You got to read some of the guys that we hold as the great authorities, because it's not so far off the mark. That is the Ramban. When he takes on the Rambam, the first real challenge to the Rambam is in Lech Lecha, Vayera, where the three angels appear to Abraham. And there it's problematic because it says God appears to Abraham, Vayera Lo Hashem, and then all of a sudden Abraham looks up and he doesn't see God, he sees three angels. This was actually a great text for, as you would expect, Christians, because this was beautifully played into the Trinity. Right, Abraham sees God, and then he looks up and he sees three. Beautiful, played right into to Trinitarians. The Rambam says wherever you have an appearance of an angel or God speaking, it's always in a dream or a vision. It's a psychological experience. It never is happening in real life. The Ramban really, really takes them on at this point, and here it's critical. And again, in terms of conceptions of Torah, he says, what are you talking about? Where does reality end and imagination or dream begin? Because these angels, these very same angels, if they're only in the mind of Abraham, are the same ones that Sarah cooks for, that eat, that travel to Lot, that stay with him, and that Sodom and Gomorrah. So he says, what are you talking about? So where does it end? So the whole Torah is just a vision? Very good point. Well taken. Very well taken. And one of the reasons, by the way, I love Nachmanides for his honesty. That is that honesty that we don't have anymore in our day and age. Because in our day and age, people try to flatten everybody out to say the same thing. Right? No, the Rambam, and I often have arguments with guys, which I stopped doing it because it's just useless. People in my community, where I'd say the Rambam says the following, and which is true because I said it. And they'll, no, the Rambam can't say it. Why can't he say it? Because it doesn't coincide with their notion of what Judaism is about. Well, if that's the case, then why do you bother to read books? Because if you're not willing to be open and read something to tell you something new, then what's the point? The Ramban knew exactly what the Rambam was saying and said, I don't like what you're saying, and you are wrong, or worse, we've seen language, and I'm going to take you on. I like that better. Whether you agree with him or not, I like that better, because at least there the argument is clear. He's not distorting the Rambam. Maybe sometimes he does, because he didn't really know the original languages that the Rambam wrote in. But I know where you are. I know where you stand. And I'm going to give you enough respect to at least take you on and take you at your word. So here he does, and he says, it's impossible. You don't understand the secret of the garment. The secret of the garment is that the divinity can come down clothed in a corporeal being. And that's what happened here. I don't have time to go into that, but that's basically the argument. The truth is that this could actually not just be an angel, but it actually could be an aspect of God in terms of the Sefirot. The Shekhinah, the lowest of the Sefirot, actually can be embodied in this world, in the Ramban's view. And the Rambam, I would say, if he heard that, the politest thing he would do if he heard that from one of his students would be to kick him out and expel him from his school. He might vomit. They might have to take him away to a hospital for it. But literally, the reaction to something like that would be quite visceral, quite visceral. I'll end there because it's enough. But at the end of the day, I'll just read you because I've been working on this and people have worked on it, but I'm working on a particular aspect in terms of their conceptions of history and their conceptions of the founding of Judaism and what goes into Jewish identity. On that score, they also have very, very different views. And the truth is that in terms of our shared collective memory, we remember different things. We have different histories. So this is what I write in the. I'll just read to you because I think I kind of got it right when I started this. Moses Maimonides and Moses Nachmanides, arguably the two greatest of medieval expositors of Jewish thought and law, vehemently disagreed on virtually every substantive issue crucial to Judaism as a belief system. Their positions diverged so drastically on notions such as prophecy, providence, ritual, biblical history, and even the very nature of God and monotheism. I would say quite literally that if we think that the Yud Gimel Ikarim of the Rambam is what makes or break a Jew, the first, Mark Shapiro, and you know Mark Shapiro very well, used them lots of times, the one thing I would criticize his book for, which is an excellent book, is his not dealing with the first two. Because he seems to think that the first two, nobody had a problem with. That is the belief in the existence of God, the belief in the oneness of God. I would say that the biggest problem is with those two. Because what everybody mouths as their subscription to the belief in the existence of God and the unity of God is not what Maimonides had in mind. And the God that Nachmanides believed in was, I'll read it to you, what I have. It would be no exaggeration to state that they subscribed to two different faiths. Though barring any technical disagreements, they practiced more or less the same religion, as embodied in the rabbinic legal tradition, or halakha, within which they expressed their practice radically conflicted. The faith. Nachmanides' mystical conception of God is a composite one, bearing a multiplicity of attributes, and about whom much can be known and positively asserted. While Maimonides' God is an irreducibly unified being, absent of any attribute whatsoever, who can only be described in negative terms, and who essentially eludes all linguistic attempts to grasp him. Nachmanides' God is a God of history, affected by and responding to the world and human conduct. While Maimonides' God is stable, constant, immutable, and invulnerable by definition to any affectation. Miracles are a commonplace of Nachmanides' world, while natural causation is the operative rule of Maimonides' world. Guided as he was by a rabbinic maxim he was particularly fond of, Olam kiminago nohag, the world goes on its customary way. Maimonides would have considered, and here's the punchline, Nachmanides' worship, and I say this, by the way, as no exaggeration. Maimonides, of course, did not know Nachmanides because he lived after him. Nachmanides lived well after him. Nachmanides, of course, knew Maimonides and took him on. Maimonides would have considered Nachmanides' worship at best directed toward a non-existent deity or, at worst, idolatry. Nachmanides would counter that Maimonides has philosophically emasculated God to such an extent as to vacate spirituality and worship of any relational dimensions traditionally associated with them, leaving a lifeless faith. Those are two models, and I don't mean here a machloikis about whether Wrigley's chewing gum is kosher or not. I mean here essentially two different religions, practiced the same, but conceptions in terms of theoretically, conceptually, faith-wise, believing in two different, and here's again where I would talk, just critique Mark Shapiro, two different gods, not the same unity, not the same existence. Thank you. Do we have time for some questions, sir? I'll have to give Paul the priority. Who wrote it? Oh, you're asking a lot of questions here. I have answers to all of them. I don't think I have the time to really. I would say on all of them again, there is such a essential distinction between the two. So I'll just take the narratives. Maimed Har Sinai, even the revelation of Har Sinai, are so polar opposite between the two. But I don't think I really have the time to go into it. But the narratives. Nachmanides he adopts a rabbinic maxim which governs a lot of the way he reads historical narratives. Historical narratives are archetypes. The Torah embodies all of history. So I suppose those who are interested in the nonsense of Bible codes, this would feed into that. That is all of human history, but I think even Nachmanides would think that, predicting who will win the mayoralty race in Toronto would be nonsense. That would be to trivialize the Bible. But he did think that all of history, all of human history in the 6 days, in the 7 days of creation, and all of Israelite history is embodied in the patriarchal narratives and the Israelitic narratives. So, for instance, Maase Avot Siman Labanim, Kol Mashi Ira LaAvot, will happen. Anything that happened to the Avot will happen. So that's the way he perceives all the narratives. So, for instance, let me give you one example, and that will suffice. Maimonides, on the other hand, I'll give you an example. Maimonides, on the other hand, looks at historical narratives, and he deals with it. And he said historical narratives have two purposes, one or the other. Either, alternatively, either it teaches us some moral, right? So again, a primer, or it helps us understand a mitzvah. A mitzvah, right? So I'll give you for instance. The long genealogies, there are the battles that Abraham has with the kings, precisely because those are so trivial. That's precisely why Kabbalah seizes on those and makes them the most pregnant with meaning. Okay? That's the way you deal with that. The things that are most meaningless, because they are meaningless to us, become the most meaningful. Well, it's just a secret. So so for instance, Maimonides will say, oh no, the battle with the four kings that Abraham has embodies all of future history. They symbolize, not just symbolize, they embody, and guarantee that our future will be under four empires, right? Each one becomes a reference to some other empire. The last one is the one we are, that is Nachmanides in his own current environment, Edom, which stands for Rome, which stands for Christianity. And their ultimate defeat, because Abraham ultimately defeated them. So that's what that stands for, right? For Maimonides, it stands for a moral, right? Because what did Abraham do? He defeated the four kings, but what he did because one of the reasons he went to war against them was to Lot, right? His relative was taken captive, and when they offered him, he said, "I don't want anything from you. I just want my person back." So it teaches the great moral that he was willing to sacrifice himself. By the way, it's interesting, not for his relative, but for somebody who shared a common belief, and that also tells you something. The long genealogies of Esav and his descendants, for Maimonides, again for Nachmanides, are archetypes for the future. They embody the future. Not just they embody the future, but when we look at the Torah, we can understand, if we know how to read it, our future. Ontologically, that is essentially, right? This captures all of history. For the Rambam, no, it has a practical reason. In Dvarim, it says that when you have the laws governing kings, that one of the things you can't do is appoint a king who is a foreigner. So he says, this story helps us understand why you can't. Because all these nations had foreign kings over them, and they ended up lousy. They ended up just deteriorating. That tells you, it helps us understand the mitzvah. So again, the answer is practical, pragmatic, either from a theoretical point of view, either it teaches us philosophical conceptions that are true, or moral conduct. But for the Ramban, of course, it's much more. So again, the conception of the Torah, they're two different Torahs, two entirely different Torahs. Anybody else? Yeah. Yeah, okay. So I'm not a historian, and I'm very averse to reducing to historical reductionism. So I take these people. I only mention the biographical material because that's what it is. And of course they were influenced by their environments, but I think it goes much deeper than that. I don't think people are just products of their environments, and people can be creative. Even being influenced, right? So some historians like to just reduce everything to, yeah, he took this from that guy. I don't buy that. So it's not a matter of plastic. I would actually, it's not disturbing to me at all. I got over that a long time ago. I think to me, actually, it's quite, first of all, fascinating from a scholarly point of view, but quite rich. That is, we have a number of models in Judaism, contrary to what people would have you think, which you can pick. Right, you can choose which model you want. as long, again, as you practice kind of more or less the same in terms of their conceptions of Judaism. So halacha is what binds them, again, more or less, barring any technical disagreements. But let no one tell you that this is what Judaism... When somebody tells me this is what Judaism stands for in terms of belief, I run for the hills. Because here you have just... I have a paradigm in terms of these two, because these are the two giants of the medieval thinkers. But they both paved very, very, I think, different, profound. Now, I chose a number of issues that may not seem profound at their, at their very essence, but they lead to all kinds of other consequences. But for the very nature of God, who it is we're worshiping, when we daven, Nachmanides thought of a different God than the Rambam did. And I would say, with no exaggeration again, that he would have, Maimonides would have thought that he violated his first number of principles, the Yud Gimel Ikrim, which we take so sacrosanct. I don't know how sacrosanct they could be if they only arrived in the 12th century. We never had Yud Gimel Ikrim before that. And not only did they arrive in the 12th century, but I would bet you, go to the most religious guys you find in your shul and ask them to tell you, what are the 13 principles? A, they probably won't be able to. Now, that's pretty curious. If these are the principles on which our faith are based, but for sure they won't be able to tell you, many of them, where they are, where the Rambam wrote them, and in what language. So it's curious to me that you wouldn't have this in other faiths, where if you had a catechism or some kind of dogma. If you were a Catholic, and these are kind of the Trinity, Jesus incarnate, they would know them, right? And they would be able to recite them. So that indicates to me how seriously we take them. We don't really seriously take them. We don't take them that seriously. But in terms of what goes into the unity of God, the way Maimonides conceived of the unity of God, he would have considered Nachmanides an idolater. At worst. At best, serving something that doesn't exist.
That's what I'll talk about.
Well, yeah. For Maimonides. For somebody like Maimonides. Yeah, only for Maimonides and his camp view. I'm not making a judgment here, right? Although I have my preferences, but that's, I think, the way Maimonides would view Nachmanides. Yeah. The Rambam?
Rambam.
I would have to disagree with you. I think that at the end of the day, from what I see, the Ramban has won out. I would say that the conceptions of Judaism out there, in terms of conceptions of Torah, conceptions of God, Kabbalistic tendencies are very, very strong, even for those, people I'm from in the yeshiva world, subscribe to Kabbalistic notions, even not knowing that they are Kabbalistic. They've seeped into the mainstream. If I hear rabbis, quoting things that, the Zohar HaKodesh, or the Ari, right? Which the acronym, you know what the Ari stands for? Isaac Luria is Eloki. And they're referred to this way, right? They're referred to this way, which means that somehow the mystical Kabbalistic tendencies and their notions of God have become actually the dominant features. Even if one is not a chassid, many of us, I would say, subscribe to those notions. Now, halacha is a different matter. The Mishneh Torah is a different matter. However, and Mark Shapiro actually wrote a marvelous, very lengthy article on this as well. Even in halacha, the Rambam tried to cleanse, in a sense, or purify all those halachot. There are actual halachot that emerge from the Talmud that are related to superstition and demons. Whenever we come to halacha like that, the Rambam either conveniently leaves out that point or cleanses it, purifies it. So even in halacha, he tried to, but of course halacha, you're absolutely right in terms of halacha. He had a great influence in terms of halacha. But I'm talking about theoretical conceptions. That is, when you have the halacha and when you practice the halacha, who are you doing this for? Which I think is more fundamental, right? Than differences in terms of, you know, how I do this certain thing or whether something is, you know, I can't do on Shabbos or I can do on Shabbos or whatever it is. It's very much more fundamental, a much more fundamental disagreement. And by the way, the Ramban, of course, took the Rambam on vigorously on his enumeration of the mitzvot.
The Ramban has his own?
Well, not his own. You can extract his own, but you know, if you look at the Sefer Mitzvot, the Rambam, who himself took on a previous authoritative enumeration of the 613, the Ramban went to great lengths to destroy the Rambam. I mean, very technical arguments, but just a continuous, sustained assault on the Rambam's. By the way, and so again, there you go. If you think that the thing we all take sacrosanct, 613 mitzvahs. Oh yeah, 613 mitzvahs. What are they? I have a news for you that they're very different conceptions of what in fact they are. What the Rambam enumerates in 613, the Ramban, says you're crazy. So even on that. Right? Yeah. I mean, Kabbalat HaShabbat is taken from the Tzfat, from the right, that whole cup, which many people don't know, turning around in Bo'ichala. Even the prayers were composed by, you know, Shlomo Alkabetz and it were by guys. These were all rituals that were done, mystical rituals, and we've dubbed them as normal. I would dare say that many people don't know that, probably don't know the origins of that. But when you say that, when you daven that, when you daven the poem, these poems had very, very definite reference in the Kabbalistic system to Sfirot, to all kinds of things. You know, Bo'ichala, you're welcoming the Shechina, and you couple with the Shechina, and the whole idea of even having sex on Friday night is an enactment of the conjugal relations within the Godhead, between Tiferet and Shechina, between, right, to bringing the male part and the female part of God together. When you have sex with your wife, you're actually doing that. And that's why Friday night you do it. Anyways, I can go on and on. But yeah, you're absolutely right.